stand, please. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-7094. Angel Medina versus District of Columbia Appellate. Wilson for the appellate, and the United for the appellate.
Good morning.
Good morning. If it please the court, I am Mary Wilson for the District of Columbia in this case. The trial court specifically instructed the jury that the plaintiff could succeed simultaneously under his federal claim and his Human Rights Act claim, and that the jury was not to worry about double damages. Fully consistent with that instruction, the jury awarded double damages by awarding the same amount twice for the same underlying wrongdoing of same underlying act of retaliation under both the federal claim and the local claim. The trial court erred as a matter of law by failing to reduce that verdict by half. This court has already established that it's a cardinal principle of law that a plaintiff can recover only once for one injury. To do otherwise, to make the plaintiff more than whole, grants them a windfall to which they are not entitled. Here, considering the factual record in this case, the court gave the same instructions to the jury. The jury verdict itself reads identically for the four questions the jury was asked to answer for the federal claim and local claim. It is plain on this record that this was an award of double damages. Each jury verdict question says, relates to the denial of the application to return to the Office of Internal Affairs in 1998 and the selection of a white officer. So it's clear both claims relate to the exact same wrongdoing. The legal standards of liability were the same. The plaintiff's counsel's closing argument was the same. The complaint lumps the claim together and asks for only one award of damages. So there was no legal basis in the record.
The trial judge seemed to be guided in his thinking by the Martini case. How do you distinguish this situation with the Martini case?
Well, we submit that the Martini case actually helps us here, because Martini held there that considering the record as a whole, there was no legal basis in the record for the jury to distinguish between the claims. And we submit that the record here is the same, is that on this record, there was no way for the jury to distinguish between the
Did Martini involve an underlying set of operative facts that were the same but violated different statutes?
Yes.
Martini
was a Title VII and a Human Rights Act claim.
Right.
And the jury and the court gave one set of instructions for both claims, and there was no way to distinguish between them. So there's a presumption that
didn't Martini allow for the possibility that you could have one underlying set of operative facts that violated two statutes and therefore have two sources of recovery?
No, to the contrary, Martini says that there it was a Title VII claim and a Human Rights Act claim based on the same facts and the same legal theory. And
you could recover under the Title VII, and you could recover under the local statute. Is that not right?
No, I think to the Martini says where there's no basis to distinguish between the two claims, and there's no distinct evidence as to harm on the two claims, that it would be that the plaintiff is only entitled to recover once for the same injury. And there, the confusion was that the plaintiff awarded different amounts of punitive damages. But the court said the only rational way you could read the verdict was, based on the record, was that the jury meant for the plaintiff to have the totality, both amounts added together. Here, the only rational way you can read the record, considering the jury instruction, that the court's instruction to the jury that they had to consider both claims simultaneously and should not worry about double damages. The only way you can rest and read the verdict.
I understand that the gravamen of your argument, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you step back and look what was happening in Martini and look at what's happening here, your argument is that it's fairly clear that in Martini the jury was being instructed that to the effect that you want to sock them for $3 million, you can do it. We're going to figure out how you do it. You just didn't check the right boxes to do so. Jury intent was the key there, as you're saying is here. I'm getting at something maybe a little more fundamental, and that is, as I understand it, in Martini there were two separate causes of action for the same wrongdoing. Is that right? One under the federal statute and one under the state, the local regulation. Is that right?
Yes, there were two theories of liability.
Right. And when you have two theories of liability, can you not have two separate sources of recovery? Isn't that what happened in Martini? You got a damage under one, you got an award under the federal, got an award under the local.
Well, the claims were essentially identical under the federal and under the local. So the plaintiff could recover the totality of his loss under the federal or the local, but not both.
Okay. Let me ask you about, in this case, plaintiff had initially alleged discrimination and also retaliation.
Yes.
The jury didn't find discrimination in this case. Had they done so, though, could plaintiff have recovered for both?
No. On this record, no. If there was a situation where the plaintiff could testify to distinct damages for the retaliation and distinct and different emotional distress for the retaliation, then perhaps. But on this record, the only evidence was a general description of general anxiety over not returning to his assignment of choice. It was not correlated or to either the federal claim or the local claim. So, and that's the way it was argued to the jury too, just, he suffered retaliation and he has anxiety and emotional distress as a result. Based on this record, there would be only one set of damages here.
So, I mean, it seems like if you had the jury finding that there was discrimination, because he alleged that happened when he didn't get promoted, right? But that the retaliation was not allowing him to go back to a job that he preferred. But in your view,
well, he had
that's not two injuries.
He had different claims of discrimination related to various acts. I think one of the claims of discrimination was that it was discrimination not to return him to internal affairs. So the jury said, no, it wasn't discrimination, but it was retaliation. But if it had said both on this record, it nevertheless would have just been, it's one injury, his failure to return, and therefore one set of damages.
Is it the district's view that one can bring a 1983 claim for retaliation when the allegations that the Equal Protection Clause is violated? No circuit court has found that, and yet
yes.
You didn't contest that.
We did not contest
Why
that.
Why not?
Well, his federal claim is murky in this record. It started out as a title.
I understand, yeah.
Right. We perhaps could have argued that he didn't have a retaliation claim under 1983, but he would have had the same claim under the Human Rights Act.
Right.
The nature of the federal claim evolved over the course of the litigation, but we never raised the objection that retaliation isn't covered by the Equal Protection Act. Because he would have had the same claim under the Human Rights Act, and he would have been entitled to one award of damages for that one injury. So if there are no other questions from the court, I'll save my remaining time for any rebuttal and urge the court to order that the damages be vacated by half. Thank you.
Counsel for Appley.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. It's our contention that What we're really looking at is two separate harms because of the nature of the constitutional claim. And there are, just looking at the jury instructions and comparing the jury instructions from one to the other, the 1983 claim was designed to remedy individuals who deprived of their constitutional rights under color of state law. And so therefore we had to prove that the conduct flowed from municipal policy, policymaking authority, and prove custom and practice, and that it was pursuant to a long-standing policy.
What was the harm that Mr. Medina suffered? It was a physical harm, right? Physical and emotional harm.
Well, it's a physical and emotional harm.
And what was that? What was
but
that?
If
what,
you,
was, what was the nature of it? What were the symptoms of it?
The symptoms at the testimony at trial was respect that he actually sought counseling and advice for the repercussions and the conditions at work. And in addition, because of the retaliation. But there was further testimony that in the context of the Metropolitan Police Department, a particular position that you might obtain actually puts you in a better light for other positions, and therefore he suffered because he wasn't allowed to return to what was considered to be a fairly prestigious job.
That's a reputational injury, so he had emotional injury, reputational injury.
Correct.
And out-of-pocket expenses for counseling, things of that nature.
That's correct. The record
and what was the total of that?
We didn't calculate, as I recall it, the total.
That's the harm, though, right? Reputational, loss of reputation, emotional distress, cost of counseling, those things. Right? That's the harm.
That's the harm
the damages was to reimburse him, to compensate him, right? The theory is that before he was subject to bad conduct, he was in a certain state of mind and a certain state of wellness. Afterwards, he was less well, and there was a certain amount of money to compensate him for those differences, right? And what I'm trying to get at is what was your theory as to the difference between Mr. Medina before the bad conduct, before the bad actions against him, and those after? How much was that worth?
Well,
monetized?
I think in terms of special damages, you know, what we were looking at is the fact that, you know, the value of being deprived of your constitutional rights has a value to be determined by a jury in terms of, you know, there are cases that discuss the fact that it's up to the jury to decide the value of a constitutional right once they determine that the harm has occurred. There are some cases that suggest, for example, that once the jury has determined there's a constitutional violation, that a minimum, there's a nominal damage that would be attached to that particular harm. So I didn't stand in front of the jury and say I want $10, $20, or $40 for a particular harm that he suffered, but we described his set of circumstances and how it impacted him, and then left it to their judgment to resolve it. As we were arguing here, is that
there was a different set of harms he suffered from the retaliation under 1983, as opposed to the harm that he suffered for the retaliation under the Human Rights Act?
I think so, because I think the constitutional harm is a distinct harm in and of itself that the D.C. Human Rights Act cannot address. It cannot address what it is like to be deprived of your constitutional rights
Did you cite us to any case that says that you can bring a 1983 claim for retaliation under the Equal Protection Clause?
I wasn't prepared for that particular issue because no one's raised it before.
Isn't that the constitutional harm you're claiming? What's the constitutional harm you're claiming?
The constitutional harm we were complaining of was that he had been deprived of his constitutional rights under...
What constitutional rights was he deprived of?
He was treated differently than other similarly situated persons.
That's the equal protection claim.
Correct.
That's your 1983 claim, right?
Correct.
So do you have any cases that say that such a claim exists? Cause of action for retaliation under 1983 that sounds in the Equal Protection Clause? I'm not aware of any, and every circuit court that I'm aware of has said there is no such cause of action. But well, you didn't point it.
The issue didn't come up before, and I don't have a case for you today that I can cite to you, Your Honor, in all honesty. But that was the claim that we were raising. As you recall, at the beginning, we discussed it.
The theory is that because he was the target of retaliation that violated the Equal Protection Clause, that harmed him somehow in a different way than the harm than retaliation that created a cause of action under the Human Rights Act?
Yes. Yes.
They were different emotional responses, different physical responses, different counseling sessions?
I don't think the different counseling sessions are different in that regard, Your Honor, but I think that a constitutional violation is a different species a different cause of action. And to the extent that you equate it to a simple tort, that you minimize the harm of suffering a constitutional violation, meaning these are rights that we hold sacred. The Constitution has a certain place in our jurisprudence. And so what we're saying is, Your Honor, is that we have a constitutional harm here. And so when one has been deprived of their rights as a citizen of the United States, that's different from being deprived of a statutory violation determined by essentially a state legislature, meaning essentially you have a situation where the legislature has determined that a discrimination is wrong, and this is how we're going to address it. That's one issue altogether. But on the other hand, we have an issue where their constitutional rights have been violated. And so we're looking at the two as being two separate and distinct harms because of that. And that's our theory here. And the D.C. Human Rights Act cannot even address or begin to address the harm suffered under the Constitution. It's not designed to. The District of Columbia indicated that the instructions were the same. The instructions are different, as we pointed out in our brief. The questions are different, as we pointed out in our brief, in terms of how the questions were presented to the jury for their consideration. And so, Your Honor, we believe that it doesn't fit the same pattern of the cases where you have the exact same instructions and the exact same injury presented in a double recovery theory. It would be a stronger scenario would be if, at least for the District of Columbia, would be if you had a situation where you had Title VII and the D.C. Human Rights Act. But even under Martini, those claims are considered to be different, and that's why in the Martini case, the court allowed the plaintiff there to keep the additional damages above the $300,000 cap that would have been imposed by the Title VII case. So you were allowed to recover for both areas and two different sources of recovery. And here
our cases have recognized a distinction where you're talking about punitive damages, but all we're talking about here is compensatory damages.
But even I understand that. But even Martini, I believe the $300,000 was a compensatory damage cap under Title VII, and so that was what was being discussed there. And so even though the issue isn't exactly the same, they were really looking at whether is there a way to support the additional award above the $300,000 cap. And the answer to that question was yes. We'll look at the totality of the circumstances and conclude that that money was to be awarded under the D.C. Human Rights Act. The implication is that there's a recognition of two sources of damages, even a compensatory scenario.
Is your strongest case Martini?
I would believe so, Your Honor. Our strongest case would be Martini.
I mean, this is not, your theory is not based on a claim that somehow the constitutional claim addresses a narrow injury and the Human Rights Act addresses a broader, or vice versa. That's not your claim.
It's more in a sense of Your Honor, that we have two different statutes with two different purposes and ends that they're meant to address, and we're allowed to proceed under both theories and with two different sources.
In other words, I understand that theory where, say, the Constitution covers points A and B, but the statute covers A, B, and C. But that's not this case, is it?
True, but in Martini, it was a similar scenario there also. You were looking at compensatory damages. They both covered A, and they both recovered under A. If the Martini court had concluded that it was a double recovery, perhaps they would have, I guess you can look at it two ways, actually. If the Martini court could have concluded that the recovery was under the D.C. Human Rights Act and awarded it that way and said there was, therefore, it's all right to give an amount in excess of $300,000, or the Martini court could have reached another conclusion and said that the Title VII cap applied, and somehow know that you were limited to $300,000, but the actual result was to conclude that the $300,000 cap did not apply and that there was a second source of damage that was recognized, at least as by the result in Martini and that conclusion. So I believe that is, would be the strong.
Just ask one other thing. In your complaint, we're talking about count five, mm-hmm. right? And in paragraph 114, you say, as a result of defendant's breach, the plaintiff has suffered emotional distress and humiliation.
Correct.
So even though this count is addressing both the constitutional and the statutory claim, you don't identify or suggest any differentiation between the harm that was suffered.
Well, in a complaint, Your Honor, I don't
believe... No, I'm not trying to tie you to the complaint, but
sure.
I'm just trying to find some source where you identified what Judge Griffith was exploring with you, the difference in the nature of the harm suffered.
Well, I think that at the... I'll think about that because I wasn't asked that question before. So I'm thinking about the... as you know, we've been doing this for 10 years, so I'm thinking about the trial testimony right now and whether there was something that focused on that. And I know that in the trial testimony there was a focus on what it felt like to be discriminated against on the basis of your national origin. But as I think about that testimony, it would have dual applicability. It would have applicability as to deprivation of your rights under the Constitution, and it also would have applicability to the other a straight discrimination claim. So I can't say that the testimonial evidence or the documentary evidence would probably tend to prove both claims or both statutes at the same time.
And to what extent do you think the jury instructions supported your theory, other than just mentioning, you know, the statute in one instruction and the local statute in one?
Well, I think that we actually had to introduce evidence with respect to the custom and practice and the pattern that existed over time. So, for example, Judge Hennessy testified about the history of this. We had to introduce evidence about the involvement of the policymakers in this regard with respect to, I believe, Chief Thomas and whether he was aware of these issues or ignored these issues. So there is a whole series of evidentiary points we had to make in order to make out the claim, and the jury instructions followed that in regard to if we didn't prove custom and practice and that it had been ignored and that a policymaker had been involved, we wouldn't have been able to make out proof. And so I think that you have to look at our proof and tie it together with the purpose of the statute in terms of making a determination as to whether we're addressing the same harm or not. And so that's what we mean when we say we're addressing a distinct issue under one statute versus the other. If not, the proof would be the same to prove one versus the other. That's why I say it would be a stronger argument if we were looking at Title VII and the D.C. Human Rights Act, where they do tend to give out, at least in this jurisdiction, the same set of instructions to address those two harms. And here, the instructions are quite different. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. counsel for appellant?
The plaintiff had every opportunity in this case, from his complaint to the evidence, testimony to his argument to the jury, to show separate damages or distinct harms. And nowhere in the case did he do it, and so the record simply does not support separate damages. And there's a presumption that the jury had to act that the jury acted rationally and reasonably, and therefore the verdict has to be read as awarding one award of $90,000. And just briefly, this court ruled in Carter, relying on Supreme Court precedent, that there's no damages for the abstract value or importance of a constitutional right. Recovery is limited to the actual loss, and that was what the plaintiffs requested here, and therefore the court should adjust the verdict to compensate him only once.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.